Welcome to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. This podcast is all about conversations about healing and rising from the ashes of your grief and trauma. In this podcast, we will be deconstructing and highlighting the different aspects of grief and loss. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Zampatella. Welcome to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. I am your host, Dr. Christina Zampatella, and today's topic is on pet loss, which is an often, very often overlooked topic. And today we're going to welcome back Dr. Rebecca Morse, who is going to speak very passionately about this topic. And I'm excited that you're here. So thank you for being here again. Why don't you go ahead and just, you know, for people who maybe didn't get your intro before, just, you know, who are you? Introduce you to us.
Thank you so much. So as Dr. Z said, I'm Rebecca Morse. I'm the director of research training at a university in Virginia, so Divine Mercy University. I'm also involved in a lot of organizations that really advocate for death education and grief, such as the Association for Death Education and Counseling and Dr. World Productions, where I'm Dr. Virginia USA 2023, where my platform is death education, grief, and loss. And so I'm also, as my students could tell you, a pet lover. I love animals. I have my whole life. And so this is something I care deeply about and really is an area that speaks to the deepest part of me.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that so often our pets are a very strong attachment for us. And so there are people that love animals for animals' sake, right? They're part of the environment, the ecosystem. And so they're very passionate in that regard. But for some of us, they're actually one of our strongest attachments because of the nature of the relationship. It's very different. And so I think for many, it is a very strong attachment bond, and it doesn't replace a human bond, but it's something that is its own thing. And for many of us, enriches our lives and makes us happier and healthier.
There's a lot of research behind that too, about how, you know, people with animals often will live longer. And we'll go back to the attachment because I got a really cool example that I had that a client of mine has given me permission to talk about, which I'm very excited about because it becomes a real, you know what I mean, a real thing. And I think if you've heard any of my previous podcasts or you watched any of the intro, I make it very clear that my animals are my favorite people in my house, which I'm sure that's much to the chagrin of my husband and I don't think the kids care so much, but my husband's probably, okay, he's my very favorite, but then my animals are the second favorite. And I've had animals my entire life and every single one has hit me in different ways in when I've lost them. And each one I've had a very unique relationship. Some are, and this is interesting too. Some I've been more attached to than others, personality wise, which I find that really interesting. And maybe we can touch base on that, but when we're thinking about grief and we're thinking about trauma, you have to think about attachment. You have to think about attachment. And for some people who are very isolated, it may be the only attachment that they have. Or some people who grew up in very neglectful or abusive homes, they may be the only safe attachment that they've ever had or one that they're willing to, you know, open up to. They may have other attachments in their lives, but they don't feel as safe in those attachments as they do with animals with this kind of unconditional love. Although I think my cats are a little bit more conditional than my dog. I think my cats are like, you are two kibbles short of an entire full bowl of food. So screw you. And now you're not my favorite human being. And I'm going to go over here and meow until ever. So
this attachment is so key. And even if you have a rich, full life with lots of wonderful, secure attachments, they can still be one of our strongest sources of comfort. I mean, I remember a time I was engaged and going through sort of the premarital counseling, and my dad was in a rehab center because he had had a stroke. dealing with drama then with trying to take care of him and, you know, family dynamics. And then my fiance, who was stressed out about a number of things. And then my favorite cat was sick. And they were convinced, oh, it's an autoimmune thing, she'll be okay. And I knew. So I was just really stressed. And so I was beyond my wits. And I go into the weekly pre-counseling session with my fiance and we sit down and he's like, oh, how's it going? And I said, well, I love my father, my fiance, and my brother more than any other men on the face of the earth. And right now I love my sick cat more than all three of them put together.
Yeah. I can see that, especially when they're in trouble. So yesterday, okay, not last night, the night before, my dog Akaya, she's coming up on 12, right? And I can see that she's getting a little bit arthritis in her back legs. We have wooden stairs. So she went tumbling down the first set of stairs. And I watched her. She was kind of shaky. Just wanted to make sure she wasn't limping or anything. And I was just like, okay, well, you know, maybe, you know how like they get the little fur in between their. So, you know, I looked there. Okay, no, that's all. She's all groomed up. And then the next morning she did it again. So then, you know, I dropped everything. I canceled a client. We're going to the vet. Like there are priorities in life. Take her over to the vet. The vet's like, no, there's no damage, which I was like super happy about. And they're like, all right, she's going to have to be on an anti-inflammatory and this glucosamine thing. And we'll watch her liver and her kidneys and everything. And I was like, I will gouge my eyes out for this dog. Like I would do that. And, like even this morning, I went to take her outside and she was scared to come down the stairs. And I'm looking at her, I'm like, I'm too old and broken to carry you down the stairs. And so you should have seen me. Like, not only did I get on Amazon and find like little carpet things that you could put on each one of your stairs, I then bought the little stair thing that goes up onto the bed. Do you know what I mean? And
I have a couple.
I kind of sort of didn't really carry her, but got her downstairs, gave her medicine. And now all of a sudden she's running up and down the stairs again. I'm like, damn, I just spent $50 on little pieces of carpet that I'm hoping aren't going to screw up, but I'm still going to put, don't think I'm still going to put, not put them down. You know what I mean? Like, so you take care of them as if they're your child. Like, well, I do, but different people have different levels of relationships with their animals.
And that's something that's also really important is recognizing that I think one of the things that is so unique about pet loss as opposed to some of the other types of losses is that because there's such a variety of relationality between humans and animals, there is not a standard sort of set of expectations. Like most of us have an idea of how we relate to siblings, to parents, to children, to spouses. Mm-hmm. That makes it a little bit easier, I think, to understand when somebody says they've lost someone. In fact, usually it's when somebody says they've lost someone, you're like, oh, I'm so sorry. And they're like, no, it's okay. Like, that's harder for us to wrap our heads around. Whereas with animals, you can have a relationship that's based on sort of an economy. So you have a farmer who may be deeply considerate and caring of their animals, but they're not going to necessarily attach to them the same way someone would who has a domesticated pet. Mm. Right. And with that domesticated pet, I think one of the things that also makes it particularly challenging is that what I've seen and experienced myself, there's the disenfranchisement of the grief, where the relationship isn't socially supported and recognized the same way it would be with a human one. And I'll talk more about that in a little bit. The other piece of it is the guilt piece. In some ways, it is harder than any other human relationship in the sense that they don't verbalize. Nope. And some animals don't vocalize even. Right. So even an infant who's sick and not feeling well, they're going to scream. They're going to let you know for the most part, unless they're so extreme that they just can't signal the parent or an adult. Yeah. But with animals, we often don't know what's going on inside their little heads. Mm-hmm. And they hide their feelings so well. I mean, I don't know if you read, there's an article that came out recently in Japan. They now have an app. They crowdsourced images of cat faces to come up with an algorithm that AI can use to detect if your pet is in pain based on where the whiskers are, the how they're holding their jaw, the shape of how they're holding their ears.
Seriously?
Yeah, it's, allegedly it's 90% accurate based on all of these thousands and thousands of photographs.
I need that. I need that immediately.
Why is that invented? That's invented because these relationships are so important and because it's so hard to know when they need something. And that makes it so difficult because then what ends up happening is we have far more guilt when there's a crisis.
I agree.
Because we can't go back and change anything. So there's that guilt of, did we miss something in the shoulda, coulda, wouldas? The other piece that's especially difficult when we have a diagnosis, when we have discovered there's something wrong, we can't ask them what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're in a very difficult situation of, well, do I put my cat on chemotherapy, which has not the best success rate, right?
Mm-hmm.
We'll pretend it's 50-50. Well, here's the problem. Yes, there may be a 50% success rate, however, or survival, I should say. But is the trauma of going through the procedure so much that your animal, your pet, is no longer going to be bonded the same way because you're torturing them? So making that decision of what is best for the animal's quality of life, you know, veterinarians typically have a set of recommendations that they offer, which can be, is the animal still eating, drinking? Are they still trying to be social?
Mm-hmm.
When those things stop or change, that can be an indicator for people. But again, if you have an animal who's hiding their discomfort, because that's what animals do. That's a survival technique, right? It's hardwired into them to hide it.
Mm-hmm.
Guilt that we feel can be astronomical.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, veterinarians do an amazing job trying to coach people through that. But at the end of the day, it's your choice in terms of if you're going to proactively euthanize an animal. There are more humane ways to do it. I don't know if you're familiar with some of the organizations out there, like I think Lacks of Love is one of them, but they come to you. And there are a lot of services out there who provide that. And I will be perfectly honest, at least in my part of the country in Northern Virginia, it's the exact same cost as going to the actual veterinarians often. And it's cheaper than an emergency hospital. And they
that, I mean, and that's interesting because it reminds me of conversations that we have about hospice and palliative care and, you know, how I've drilled into my husband and one of my kids, because I think he's the only one that actually is going to, you know, listen to me when I say, do not let me die in a hospital. I want to die at home. Like, it's really important for me to, you know, if it comes down to it, I want to die at home. And so once in a while, I'll look at one of my kids, I'll look at Anthony, I'm like, what's the rule? And he's like, you want to die at home? I'm like, okay, I just want to make sure you still remember through all of your teenage angst. But I think it also affords a family the opportunity to make choices. Like, there's children involved. You have choices then, you know, because I'll keep using the kids. When I first met my husband, these are my stepsons. When I first met my husband, they had a dog, and that dog had to be euthanized, and nobody was talking to them about it, which, you know, of course, now I walk right up into it, right? And I'm like, okay, well, we're going to talk about that. I looked at him, made sure Jeff was all right with that. And we're sitting down and we're talking, and Nick goes, one of the kids goes, they murdered her. They murdered her. Like, he couldn't understand because nobody talked with him. And then they pulled the whole, well, she's at the farm. We had to take her out to the farm. Now, I have issues with this whole, we're taking her out to the farm. why would you want to, you know, take the dog away? Okay, the dog's still alive. Why is the dog at the farm? They're going to have a happier life than they are with us. Like, why is she going to have a happier life? Like, this is the fear that we have, right, in communication with children, in this, in our society, at least, about not wanting to discuss death. And we had an episode on children and death and ways to, you know, explore it. And in it there, I know there's different cultural values and familial values around this stuff, but research really does show that being honest in an age appropriate way really is a lot more healthy than hiding things from children who are picking up on things anyway. And they're just not, they're confused and whatnot. My very first loss was my dog getting hit by a car, that I saw her get hit by a car. It's my second memory in my life. And yeah, it was traumatic, but it wasn't hidden from, it couldn't be hidden from me. But even so, like, we had a little service for her, my mom and dad, you know, we buried her. Like, it was a whole thing. You know, I'm glad it wasn't hidden from me. So I know I'm jumping around there a little bit, but I have a lot of like thoughts about, you know, the, how do we navigate people's individual belief systems and their needs around their animals and the loss of their animals. And like, even on the Facebook pages that I, you know, that I belong to, I'll see people who said, oh, I love, you know, I lost my, you know, my 22-year-old cat from, you know, I've had my entire life. So I'm looking for a kitten, blah, 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 blah. I mean, like an immediate, you know, what do you think is going on there?
Well, you just gave like five different components.
I know. All right. Pick up on whatever the heck you want.
I'll address all of them, but I need to know. So first, just responding to the children. You know my stance on that. I have an op-ed I wrote in MedPage today about not lying to kids, right? We don't do them a service. We do them a disservice. I cannot tell you how many adults I've talked to or worked with over the years who have some traumatizing story from childhood where their parent lied to them about what happened to their animal, about how they were searching. What ends up happening when you lie to your kid about an animal's death or impending death? You've now made it an ambiguous loss.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by ambiguous loss?
What I mean by ambiguous loss is there's this suffering and hope piece that are intermingled. And we see that when you have parents who had a child who was kidnapped. If you have somebody who is in the military who's missing in action. If you have someone who is in your life, you're estranged and now you can't locate them. And you're fearful that they're dead. So there's this piece of suffering because you're wanting to process that pain, that grief, but then you can't release yourself enough to process that grief and pain because there's still a piece of hope. Now, you might feel like you're Jim Carrey in Dumb and Dumber. You mean there's one in a million chances? I've got a chance, right? But we lean into that hope because that's how we're wired frequently. Mm-hmm. And so that piece, you've now just complicated that kid's grief. And I don't mean complicated grief, but you've complicated their grief by creating an ambiguous loss. You've also taught them that they can't trust the grown-up in the room to tell them the truth when bad things happen. So you've now social modeled lying when things are uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't-
We think we're protecting them.
We think we're protecting them, but we're doing the exact opposite.
Right.
So that would be my one thing. I'm going to hop off my soapbox from that one.
No. I needed you on that soapbox. Okay. You can jump off, but that I needed you there.
Yeah. And I should send you a link to the med page today so you can see the article and possibly tag it.
Yeah. No, we'll tag it right on the YouTube thingy.
Okay. Perfect. I'll send it to you. But the other piece that you mentioned that I want to address is circling back, and I totally just lost my train of thought. I get so passionate about kids. It was what you had ended with. Oh, the cultural differences piece.
Yeah.
That was one of the other things, because there were three that I wanted to really address. With the cultural piece, I think that just recognizing that there are differences is a really good starting place. Recognizing that the family structure is one thing, but you can respect the family of origin and that culture without necessarily lying. What you might have to do is work with the grown-ups to be proper for that culture. So for example, if it's a culture where the head of the household is the oldest male, then working with them and using psychoeducation, hey, these are things that you could do, you could talk to. It's not perfect, but it can work. That can be a way, an avenue to navigate that. And recognizing that, again, those animal bonds are very different across cultures. But that also means then the grief is going to be somewhat different in how it's experienced.
Right.
So you have to take that into account. Now, there was another thing you said, and that was the one where I derailed myself. What was the last thing you had said?
I was talking about the kids, the going in, like, well, we talked about the lying and them going off, you know, out to the farm. And then this might be a good place for you guys to edit. We're going to figure out where the hell we left off. Just when I need another person in the room, this is where we need the other person in the room. Again, just edit this out. What the heck were we talking about? So, sorry, this is what I get for jumping all over the place. I got you. Because I had like this train, you know. Oh, my very first loss was the loss of my dog. I don't know. Can you hear my cat?
No, I cannot.
Okay, because he's sitting at the door meowing because he's upset. But you got yours on your lap. If I let him down here, he'll start scratching my chair. All right, I think we're going to try to stop editing the part. But that was the last part that I was talking about, was the, right?
No, that actually started one of your...
Started the whole thing.
Your thought. So...
I don't know. Damn it.
There were just so many good things in what you had said.
Yeah, I had my own little, like, I take the scenic route with my train of thought. Crap. I can't remember what it was.
That's okay. Well, if they're going to edit this out, where would you like to pick up? What would you like me to address?
Well, I like what you did. You said, you know, how you address it with the family and each family's experience of their relationship with their animal. I would like a follow-up question of like, all right, let's give our viewers and listeners like a really concrete example of what we could say, because that's what I'm going to hear from people. It's like, okay, well, you know, I hear you saying that we have to do something, like give me some examples of what to say. So that's where I'd like to pick up. All right,
ask me a question and I'll answer it.
Right. So I'm hearing you talk about like how different cultures have different relationships with their animals and how different cultures may navigate communicating those conversations with their children. Can you give like a really just a concrete, this is what, if I was your kid and something had happened to our cat, like tell me exactly some good ideas of how to approach that conversation. And maybe we can do it like based on a kid who's 5 versus a kid who's like 7 or 8, because the way we understand death and how we talk to children at different ages differs as they communicate, as they develop cognitively and emotionally.
Language skills develop. It makes it easier for the expressive component of it so that they can share. So absolutely. So I think one of the things that is really key is to recognize that children are very astute and they pay attention to what's around them.
Yep.
And what I mean by that is that a 5-year-old, even if you've never used the word dead, they understand to some degree what death is, because I guarantee you somebody in their life has squished a bug. Mm. They have squished a bug.
Right.
And understand when they squish the bug, bug doesn't come back. So, well, unless it's one of those creepy centipede things.
Yeah, the centipede things seem to have like them and like cockroaches, like what the hell, like go away. All right.
But they understand on some level. And I can give you a beautiful example of, I was at a funeral once with, it was a young mother who died, a horrific drowning accident. And I'm at the funeral, and they've got the receiving line, and you've got the kids of different ages lined up. And the youngest one was about three, and dad's holding him. And people are going by, and they're doing the very traditional thing in some parts of the country, especially in the South, where everyone takes one flower off of the casket, and you get to keep it and press it as a memento. So I'm watching this little boy watch these people take his mama's flowers. And he's getting more and more agitated. He's looking from them, looking to his dad. He's looking at his dad and his grandparents like, why is this not an issue?
Right.
They're thieving. And it's so quiet. All you can hear outside are, you know, the birds and the crickets, and there's a stream nearby. And finally he goes, Daddy, why are they taking mommy's flowers? They're the lastest she'll ever have.
Oh my God. Yeah, no, I'd be sobbing. Forget it.
So dad broke at that point. Grandpa saved the day, takes the kid, takes him into the church to ring the church bell, which is a type of distraction, right? He distracted him. And I'm sure they had a conversation because I saw them talking. But my point is that even though, yes, they may not have the same adult level of death comprehension in terms of finality and permanence, on some level, they get it. And what that means is that we don't have to lie to them. Don't use euphemisms. So you said 5 years old, right? Being able to work within the fact that you'll have a range of what the child's experience and understanding are. So in terms of if it's their pet, I am a strong proponent of, especially if you can do in-home euthanasia, letting the child be present, because usually it's a very peaceful process. And a lot of those mobile vets do a great job of articulating it, because honestly, you've got an adult who's grieving already. They're going to break it down to a kid's level.
Oh, yeah.
Letting the kids be present. If the animal is dead somewhere on its own, like it crawled under a bed or in a closet or went away outside, because sometimes they do tend to shelter when they're dying of natural causes, letting them see the body and pet it and say goodbye.
Yeah.
If you're going to bury it, bury it. If you're going to cremate it, I have a few on my bookcase.
I've got four of them upstairs. Yep.
Yeah. And so explaining to them what cremains are and recognizing that that's a way to keep them with us. These are things we can do. You don't need to give them a science lesson on decay and all of the other intricacies of the death process, the dying process, I should say. But you can tell them that the animal is dead, that they're dying. You know, it's when you're in our field, obviously we tend to surround ourselves with people who are emotionally intelligent. And I lost one of my cats, see, and even their softening language. I had a cat who died. And I had three honorary nieces and nephews that were right around that 5 to 6.5 year old age range at the time that happened. And the empathy that the kids had, one of them asked her mom, my little Reagan, she's my flower girl in our wedding. She asked her mom if she could use her savings to buy me another cat that would look like Jadzia Dax.
Okay, now you're just making me try to cry. That's
not even hurt as much.
Wow.
Honorary nephew Brenton asked his mom if he could train to be an airline pilot so that he could go to heaven and help me visit.
Oh.
And then my other one, Roman, he just jumped into my lap, gave me a hug, and he said, I'm sorry, that sucks.
Jesus Christ. Okay.
Adults aren't that good at it.
Right. They're better at it when they're kids. It's amazing.
So they each had their own way. Slightly different age range, but a lot of development happens in a year and a half. But you have a breadth there of just addressing my immediate emotions. One who wants to problem solve and realizes, well, I'm going to miss the cat here and now, so let's fix it. And another one who's recognizing, oh, well, maybe there's a way for you to continue that bond. Those are three very adult conceptualizations. Kids are smarter. If they can say Tyrannosaurus Rex, they can say cremation.
I never thought of that before.
We're the ones that put the boundaries on their limits. Now,
why don't we do that? Why don't we do that?
Because we're trying to protect the essence of what we perceive as innocence, and it's to comfort ourselves, because it is really hard to explain and describe and to go through that. Can we pause right here? And
yeah,
at this
go ahead.
My door.
No, you're fine.
There's someone at the front door, and I don't want the doorbell.
Yeah, no, that's okay. All right, guys, you're going to be editing here, just so you know.
Probably spouse.
All right, she's back.
So these are all things that we can do to help them understand. So don't lie to them. Use the words dead or dying and death. Let them say goodbye. Now, sometimes you're not going to be able to, right? A true ambiguous loss that the pet runs away.
Mm-hmm.
You can be honest with that. You can say, you know, they went exploring and they probably got confused and lost because it's a really big place out there. And we're going to do A, B, and C and hope they come home. And then after a while, if they don't come home and you're talking with the child, just saying, well, you know, hopefully another family found them and didn't know how to get them home because, you know, Fluffy or Fido can't give their home address. By the way, little kid, you need to know your home address in case you ever get lost, right? That's just me. Don't say that to your kids. But you say maybe they're with another family and that family's going to love on them because they don't know how to get them back to us. That's another way to be honest. Now, if you find out, okay, the animal was hit by a car, your experience, if it's possible to see the body, that would be amazing. If not, any sort of reassurance that that really was their fluffier Fido,
yeah,
can go a long way.
Like collars or something. Because, I mean, I can imagine as a parent, I wouldn't want my kid to be exposed to something that's very traumatic like that.
If
but some kind of, you know, like here's a little, you know, a little bit of fur that we took, you know, or like a collar or something.
Collar, fur, something like that would be wonderful. Obviously, if there's any blood or squishedness,
yeah,
unless the child witnessed it happening, you don't need to go there. But there are ways to reassure them. That's the same thing adults need. We need to know if that really was our person, or in this case, our being. And so those are things that we can do that can be very helpful and can help sort of scaffold that learning. Now, the other thing that frequently we see happen with pets is there's this huge debate of whether to replace or not, and how long do you wait?
Yeah, that's it. And I was going to say, like, let's talk about that too. So that was the other thing that we were talking about. Like, how
that may have been where I was going when I lost my train of thought earlier.
We both lost our train. This is what happens after 40, my dear. It just, and just all of you who are over, you know, over the age of 40. Start taking some kind of, I don't know, supplement to help with your brain. But anyway, go ahead.
So in terms of
the amount of time, like, that we wait to replace them?
Yes. So in terms of the amount of time in the replacing, frequently when there are animals that are relatively indeterminate features, like rats and mice and fish, there's an easy avenue that a lot of parents will take where they try to replace the pet. And one of the things that is difficult then is that you've set the stage now for lying instead of taking advantage of a natural opportunity to explain death and to work with the kid.
And that we're not replacing. You can't replace anything.
Exactly.
You can't replace anything alive like that. It's one thing to replace a bed.
Exactly. Now, I will say that there are a lot of experts that say you should not go out immediately and get a new pet because you need an opportunity to process your grief. You may feel resentful that the new pet doesn't exactly fill the family dynamic that the dead pet did. However, I will say that there's a lot of healing from getting another pet. So I'm against just a substitution where you're not telling the child or even the older adult. I knew a couple where that once happened. They were going to just swap out mammy's, their grandmammy's pet. And like, no, don't do that. That cat is dead. Get a new cat. And then with the, in terms of the length of time, really there's no set marker. I do think that sometimes we tend to hold on too long because we're used to human loss. You don't go out there and get a new grandma. You don't go out there and just get a new parent or spouse. Right? You have to build a new relationship. And with some of those roles, they can't be replaced. We can get remarried. If you're 42, you're probably not going to be legally adopted by someone.
Right.
Right. There are some relationships and roles that will never be replaced. The beauty of a pet, though, is that there are always animals who need love. And even though that pet that you lost can never be replaced, the interactions you had can never be replaced. The hole that the relationship being torn has left, you can get a new relationship. You can't go to Dad's R Us, but you can go to PetSmart.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about a client of mine who, actually not a client, somebody who called in, and he, you know, single older man. I don't know why, you know, I don't get into all that business when I'm just like gathering information, but called, like literally called the Center for Grief and Trauma Therapy because he had lost his dog. And I think it was a companion dog. I think he had dropped that bit of information, which we should probably talk about, like, you know, what does it mean to be a companion animal, emotional support animal? We don't have to go too far into that, but I get a lot of requests from the University of Delaware students over here who want to be able to bring their cats over to the dorm and that kind of thing. And a lot of therapists are like hands off with that. They're like, I don't trust. Anyway. So, I mean, he couldn't even talk about this loss without breaking down. He's like, that was the one other living attachment I had in my home. And he's seen me through difficult times. And there's always that, you know, what do they say? If you put your wife and your dog in the trunk of your car and, you know, open it up, you know, a couple hours later, who's going to be happy to see you? It's not going to be your wife. It's going to be your dog. You know what I mean? Have you ever heard that? Because I find that funny. No, now you know. Now, there you go. I gave you a new thing today. So just the loss that he had and he kept saying, I know it's weird. I know it's weird. And I just kept trying to like, hey, this is not weird. This is very natural for you to be upset. There's many people who, you know, are upset, you know, that I've worked with. There was a whole, when I went to the ADAC conference this year, one of the breakout, you know, one of the presentations was of a woman who actually has created, and there's several out there, but like an organization, like a funeral home for animals. And like, you know, some people who want to have a casket and a service and I mean, really go all out. And she's talking about like, people just minimize how important this relationship is for some people. It really, you know, it's one thing to, you know, put, you know, the, I don't know, they can go all the way from the goldfish down the toilet, which, okay, if that's your choice, that's your choice, to wanting to actually have like a whole ceremony for the loss of, you know, your dog that's been in your family for 15 years. So I think that we have to be sensitive. I mean, he, and as a, and you could like, there was just this sense that it was like, he just felt like I'm a guy, shouldn't be crying. I shouldn't be crying over this. And I just kept, you know, kind of just being there talking to him. And he, I said, well, guess what? We're starting a pet loss group. He's like, there's a pet loss group. I'm like, oh my God, I said, you're not alone. I said, your experience is your experience, but the loss of your animal, you're not alone in suffering that. And so I said, well, you know, we do have a group and maybe it would be helpful to come to the group. And he goes, I'd be very interested in that. And I've had other clients that have said, like one who keeps saying, I feel so dumb how, and that her words, I feel so dumb that I'm this attached to a dog that I've, you know, lost. I mean, she actually went into complicated grief. I did a whole prolonged grief disorder protocol with her. And because she truly was, so neglected as a child, it was the one healthy, loving, unconditional loving attachment who something that tuned into her needs that was alive and ripped her to shreds when she lost that dog. And I remember when I tracked down a couple of journals that they have out there, you know what I mean, the guided journals for the loss of a pet. And I put it down in front of her and I'm like, they have books, they have, support groups, they have this thing, this guided journal that you and I can work with in here. And she's just looking at it and she's shaking her head. She goes, I had no idea. Like, she's so pathologized that love she had for her dog and how much it shook her up in her life.
Thank you for listening to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it, subscribe, and leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. We want to be a resource for anyone who is experiencing loss, and this is a simple way you can help us spread the word. Check out our show description. There you'll find a link to connect with me on social media, as well as helpful articles and resources.